The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So between mid-March and late May of 1871, the working class of Paris, who had spent the previous year treated as fodder and pawns, first by the French Emperor Napoleon III in a war of aggression against Prussia, and then in being subjected to bombardment and siege by that same Prussian army in the fall and winter of 1870-71, and then by a successful reactionary French government led by the royalist Adolphe Thiers, for whose class an armed and radicalized Parisian working class represented an existential threat. This class, the working class, took control of their destinies by taking control of the city of what was then approximately 1.4 million people, the city having lost 700,000 other rich and middle class Parisians having fled the city in the previous 6 months. And in this they began the first mass experiment of direct democratic rule of the working class, the first mass experiment of socialism. And in many ways, the needs for the commune were forced upon the people of Paris, and in reclaiming their own agency and fighting both for their own defense and for their own liberation, the ruling classes of France and Germany, who mere months before had been at war, united to ensure the defeat of the commune and to enact what we should remember is the biggest mass slaughter in 19th century Europe, when they killed more than 30,000 communards in retribution in late May of 1871. It would be hard to understate the experience and legacy of the Paris Commune in terms of its impact on the socialist movement, and I'll be quoting from Engels and Lenin and Draper and others. People, you know, these writers consistently refer back to, and most importantly Marx, to this history. So its impact on the socialist movement, on socialist theory, more broadly on European history in the late 19th century. And yet its richness and import, as much as its tragedy, is often overlooked by today's emerging left. Given this, I have four general aims in today's talk. First and foremost, to provide some basic historical understanding of what happened between July 1870 and May 1871, primarily in Paris. Second, to point specifically to the lessons learned about the nature of the capitalist state, the need to tear down the existing apparatus, and to build back up on new foundation democratic forms. Thus, why and in what ways the Paris Commune came to represent a landmark for the tradition of the traditions of socialism from below, for the Marxist tradition. Third, to look at the diversity of political trends and competing political philosophies within the left, which made up the Commune, and to what extent these theories and commitments held up in the face of the lived challenges and reality in Paris at the time. Finally, to say a few things regarding the broader historical legacy of the impact of both the Franco-Prussian War and the Paris Commune, which had followed. I do want to add that I'm not a scholar of the Commune or France or the Franco-Prussian War, but I do hope I'm able to kick off a discussion which strengthens our understanding of this history, so better to inform the challenging fights we face today, to rebuild the mass audience for the exact same principles which so clearly motivated the communards to fight and die for these principles. Writing in 1891 on the 20-year anniversary of the last revolutionary uprising in Paris, Frederick Engels noted, quote, thanks to the economic and political developments of France since 1789, that is the French Revolution, for 50 years the position of Paris has been such that no revolutions could break out there without assuming a proletarian character. That is to say, the proletariat which had bought victory with its blood would advance its own demands after victory. In fact, following the revolution and overthrow of the monarchy and declaration of the Republic by the first commune government in 1792, which I'll speak briefly about, there had been mass democratic uprisings in Paris against the restoration of the monarchy and in defense of republicanism and democratic ideals in both 1832 and again in 1848, and actually intermittently between 1871 and 1789, or 1792 and 1871. All these were either led by or drew their mass support from the emergent French working class, which included large populations of newly urbanized and displaced rural workers or former peasants and small proprietors who generally aligned themselves with the Republican traditions. The history of the French Revolution of 1789 is much better known, but in 1832, following the installation of a constitutional monarchy led by Louis Philippe, related to Louis XVI, famously beheaded, from what was considered a more liberal wing of the royal line. Despite the mass uprisings to overthrow the previous restored Bourbon king in 1830, over 3,000 Parisian workers and youth, reinforced by Polish, Italian, and German refugees who had fled to Paris in the aftermath of the crackdown of the Republican and nationalist activities in their own various homelands, took control of much of the eastern and central districts of Paris, an uprising memorialized by Victor Hugo in Les Miserables. They were ultimately defeated when approximately 60,000 troops were called in to defeat the uprising, and about 800 people were killed and injured. And in 1848, the June uprisings were part of a process which led to the collapse of Louis Philippe. Specifically, the uprisings were staged by workers of France in 23 to 26 of June 1848, an undertaking in response to close the national workshops, which had been created to provide work and a source of income for the unemployed, albeit at a barely a survival, just enough to survive. The National Guard again was called out to quell the protests, and over 10,000 people in this instance were either killed or injured, while 4,000 insurgents were deported to Algeria. All of which is to say there's a precedent here for what we're about to discuss. In his account of the Second Republic and Second Empire, in the 18th premier of Louis Bonaparte, Marx famously noted that men make their own history but do not do so as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living. And just as they seem to be occupied with revolutionizing themselves and things, creating something that did not exist before, precisely in such epochs of revolutionary crisis, they anxiously conjure up the spirits of the past to their service, borrowing from them names, battle slogans, and costumes in order to present this new scene in world history in time-honored disguise and borrowed language. Thus Luther put on the mask of the Apostle Paul. The revolution of 1789 to 1814 draped itself alternately in the guise of the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire. And the revolution of 1848 knew nothing better than to parody now 1789, now the revolutionary tradition of 1793 to 95. In like manner, the beginner who has learned a new language always translates its back into his mother tongue. But he assimilates the spirit of the new language and expresses himself freely in it only when he moves in it, without recalling the old, and when he forgets his native tongue. One way to understand the revolutionary breakthroughs in social political life which the uprising in 1871 came to represent is as a qualitative step forward in forgetting, quote unquote, forgetting the native tongue, and towards free expression in the spirit of a new language, which we've come to understand as that of socialism. Yet it wasn't a complete step forward. The term commune itself was a historical reference to a period during the French Revolution when in 1792, at least in part as a result of foreign intervention following the storming of the Bastille, a revolutionary government was formed in Paris. The commune ruled until 1795 in this period of the most radical democratic experimentation. Three generations later, following the defeat of the imperial armies of Napoleon Bonaparte's nephew, Louis Bonaparte, known as Napoleon III, in August of 1870, and with the Prussian armies again on the march towards Paris, by September, calls for the creation of a commune began to be heard in the reconstituted working class political clubs throughout Paris, driven by the need to defend the city. It is difficult to quickly summarize the causes of what came to be known as the Franco-Prussian War. On one hand, the imperial ambitions of the French Empire was fed by a strong desire on the part of French capitalism to put a stop to the process of German unification, which represented a threat to French power on the continent, and which ironically was consecrated after the war. More cynically, from the perspective of the regime itself, an economic and political crisis was burgeoning in the Second Empire. After almost 20 years in power, politically balancing between royalist and clerical forces on the one hand and a more liberal bourgeoisie and republican forces on the other, with the popular classes largely lacking representation but generally quiescent so long as the economy boomed, as it did in the early days of the empire. With increasing political and economic crises throughout the 1860s, Napoleon III had first relaxed measures of social and political control, leading to a rebirth of radical politics and organizing in Paris and a flourishing of liberal and left-wing culture in the Second Empire. And there are people who study this period. It's a fascinating period culturally. Throughout the 1860s, the Republican opposition was gaining strength, particularly in Paris and other urban areas of working class strength. And there's much to say about what was going on in Lyon and Marseille, and I'm not going to have time to talk about it. If others know in the discussion, they should raise it. But what was happening in Paris was not unique to Paris, although it was the most important place. In the 1869 legislative election, 75% of the Parisian vote went to Republican forces, despite the supporters of the emperor winning 55% nationally. It's important to see the urban-rural divide here. This led to the worst rioting in Paris in nearly two decades, and Napoleon III's gambit to go to war with Prussia in the summer of 1870 was an attempt to recover political ground after a series of defeats and errors by the regime in late 1860s. For the part of Prussia, the attempt to reunify the German states under its leadership was a driving concern, and goading the French Empire into war was seen as a political expedient to this end. The Prussian Chancellor Bismarck was able to use the victory in the war in exactly this way, while gaining control over the former French regions of Alsace-Lorraine, which, as people probably know, become a live issue for the next century. For their part, under the leadership of the International Working Men's Association, with 20,000 active members throughout primarily Western Europe, but also the United States, and claiming to represent millions more, the French and German left were principally opposed to the coming war. In the summer of 1870, the French section of the International issued this statement: "Workers of France, Germany, and Spain." Spain was a motivating issue because there was a question of the succession of Spanish crown and where it was going to be aligned. "Workers of France, Germany, and Spain, let us denounce this war with one voice and reply to bellicose statements from those who demand a tax in blood or use public misfortune as a new source of speculation. We protest. We demand peace, land, and liberty. To our German brothers, we say, do not listen to the paid servile lackeys who want to mislead you as to the real sentiments in France. Workers of all countries, whatever the outcome of our common efforts, we, members of the International Working Men's Association, who do not recognize frontiers, we give you our commitment of unbreakable solidarity and greetings from the workers of France." For its part, the German left had the same attitude and announces, "This war serves only dynastic interests and satisfies the ambition of a few powerful individuals by playing with the lives of hundreds of thousands and the well-being of millions." The meeting greatly welcomes the stand of French democracy and the socialist workers in particular. It is in full agreement with their efforts against the war and expects that German democracy and the German workers will raise voices of opposition in the same way. Ultimately, the Prussian army quickly defeated Napoleon III. On July 16, 1870, the French government declared war, and by September 1st, Napoleon III himself, along with 100,000 troops, surrendered in the town of Sedan near the Belgian border. And on September 4th, 3 days later, in 1870 in Paris, the end of the empire and a new government was declared. However, the provisional French government of national defense was itself greatly divided. While the Prussian army turned to march on Paris, the fight between the Republican left and a bourgeois and royalist establishment right remained to be resolved. The division manifested itself as a conflict between the popular power in Paris and the government of national defense. The popular classes in Paris relied upon the National Guard, which had been built up through conscription, and which had initially incorporated up to 200,000 men and would ultimately rise to over 350,000 men, overwhelmingly working class in character. Academic historian John Merriman writes, "As imperial armies floundered, the political truce brought on by the war between the empire and the Republican opposition quickly evaporated. In Paris, revolution already appeared a distinct possibility, not least because the city's National Guard had grown in strength during the war and become an increasingly organized and militant Republican force. As of September 12th, National Guardsmen received 1.5 francs per day. They later received an additional 75 centimes for a spouse and 25 for each child. Poorer families depended on the paltry sum to purchase food. National Guardsmen elected their company officers, who in turn elected battalion commanders, workers and lower middle class men, largely unknown outside the neighborhoods. These National Guards were democratic institutions. The left considered the National Guard a balance against the professional army, recently used by the imperial regime before the war to repress strikers. The majority of the ranks drew from the working class Parisians. Although the National Guard may not have had access to the chapeau, the breech-loading rifles, the leading tech of the day, which the regular army had, it was armed and it had cannons, as we'll come to learn, importantly. The Prussian army laid siege to Paris during the fall and winter of 1870-71, and what followed was mass starvation and shelling. From mid-September until an armistice in mid-January, the Prussians barely allowed foodstuffs into the city, resulting in over 60,000 deaths, more than three times the dead from the previous winter. In the period leading up to the armistice, the regular army, at the direction of the Government of National Defense, engaged the Prussian army in a series of battles, all of which led to defeat and the surrender of at least 150,000 regular soldiers. The armistice was entered into from a decisive position of weakness for the French government. And immediately following the armistice, the Government of National Defense called for snap national elections, allowing no time for parties to prepare. And the aim was to avoid a real electoral battle and to win legitimacy for the conservative and monarchist forces. As planned, a reactionary government was elected, led by Adolphe Thiers, who Marx in the Civil War in France described as, quote, a master in small state roguery, a virtuoso in perjury and treason, a craftsman in all the petty stratagems, cunning devices, and base perfidies of parliamentary warfare, never scrupling when out of office to fan a revolution and to stifle it in blood when at the helm of the state, with class prejudices standing in the place of ideas and vanity in the place of heart. Goes on from there. Thus, in the spring of 1871, with the Prussian army still occupying France, the new government enters an agreement with the Prussians to pay them five billion gold francs in 5 years, and agrees that the Prussian troops can remain in the country, including encircling Paris, until they are repaid. And among the first new acts of the reactionary government is an end to the moratorium on items at the municipal pawn shop. It's important to understand that workers use the pawn shop to get by day to day and week to week. The London Times had a report that 2,300 poor wretches had pawned their mattresses. Starving seamstresses had pawned 1,500 pairs of scissors. How many necessities to existence were stored away in these cruel galleries? The gaunt secret frowning on us from every loaded shelf, starvation. This is the London Times, not a particularly progressive publication. The government also ended the moratorium on bills of exchange, notes of debt, including that up to 4 months of interest now must be paid. It ended the moratorium on payments of rent and ended the daily stipends to the National Guardsmen. With Thiers setting up the government in Versailles, notably in Versailles, not even bothering to attempt to set up the government in Paris, and the upper and middle classes fleeing and having fled Paris, and thus with growing unreliability of the overwhelmingly working class National Guard to the new government and to Thiers, we have the background that led to the creation of the Commune. Montmartre Hill overlooks Paris from the north of the city. And on the early morning of March 18th, Thiers ordered his troops to climb Montmartre Hill to appropriate the 171 cannons placed on the hill. Despite this government's subsequent claims to the contrary, these were purchased through the subscriptions of Parisians and had not been paid for by the government. People pocketed paid out of their pocket to purchase these guns for the National Guard. Here's how the British socialist and historian Ian Burchell describes what follows. When the troops arrived in Montmartre, they were surrounded by local people who offered them breakfast and mugs of wine. The women played a crucial role at this point. As one general described it, quote, the women and children came and mixed with the troops. We were greatly mistaken in permitting these people to approach our soldiers, for they mingled among them and the women and children told them, you will not fire upon the people. This is how the soldiers found themselves surrounded and did not have the power to resist these ovations that were given to them, end quote. When General Lecomte ordered his men to fire into the crowd, they refused. Later, Lecomte and another general were killed by the soldiers. The news spread rapidly throughout the capital and more barricades were erected. Effectively, Paris had declared itself an independent state. The revolutionary novelist and journalist Jules Valle described the joy of that first day of workers' power. It's the revolution, so here it is, the moment hoped for and waited since the father's first cruelty, since the first slap in school, since the first day without food, since the first night sleeping on the streets. Here is revenge for school, for poverty, for the coup of December 1851. There's all kinds of statements, numerous statements from the contemporaneous statements from March 1871, from people from all classes, from tourists, from foreigners, about understanding this incident for exactly what it was, which was a democratic revolt of the working class and the poor. It became clear to the leadership of the National Guard that a civil war had then begun with the government of Thiers. Following the events of March 18th, they gathered and decided to hand over power to an elected commune. and set the date for a March 22nd election, which actually took place a few days later. On the one hand, in the broadest sense, the meaning this had been prepared for and was clear, as I just mentioned. It was clear what the Declaration of the Commune meant. However, turning over the running of Paris from the National Guard, which direct elections from working class constituents, to an elections based on the arrondissements, the neighborhoods, the boroughs, meant a change in the class character of the representation. Unlike the National Guard Central Committee, the Communal Council emerged from a conventional electoral system where there is no organic link between elector and representative, and voting decisions are influenced by established reputation rather than collective action. As a consequence, the balance in the council reflected the level of support for well-known political tendencies rather than the social composition of the electorate itself. Thus, the council had 5 small traders, 1 owner, 2 former officers, 25 from the liberal professions, doctors and lawyers, 16 white-collar employees, and 21 manual workers. In general, it also soon became clear that while a revolutionary perspective animated almost all of the thinking about the commune, there were important divisions over what this meant. In a few minutes, I'll discuss in more detail the competing ideological trends within the commune. But for many of the left Proudhonists, what animated the thinking was what quote-unquote anti-governmental principle, war on the conception of the unitary state and despotic centralism. For others of the Jacobin or Blanquist persuasion, the revolution was a continuation of greater or lesser radicalism, of the fight for equality and the dictatorship of the people. This tension suffused the short history of the decision-making and struggles within the commune. And as an initial matter, for example, the Blanquist argued for an immediate taking of the war to the Versailles government in late March of 1871, putting all else on hold until victory had been achieved. This was not done, and the ability of Thiers to reconstitute the national army with the vast assistance of the Prussians after the events of March ultimately dictated the short life of the commune. Nonetheless, in those weeks, the commune fought for and achieved historic victories. This included the direct election of all representatives based on universal suffrage for men. And it's important to note that despite the gains for women in the commune, which I'll speak to in a second, the right to vote was not granted, as well as instant recallability of all elected representatives. A maximum salary of 15 francs a day, or 6,000 francs per year. Thus, for example, one of the members of the council's highest body, the executive commission, who was also head of the finance commission, received a single salary, and his wife continued to take in washing to make ends meet. The idea that was no representative should earn more than the average worker. The executive commission formed 9 subordinate commissions, and there was no separation between a legislative body and an executive body. The members of the commune or people were elected to then work on these commissions: finance, education, justice, security and military affairs, labor, industry and exchange, external relations. In Paris, 19 of 20 people in Paris at the time were renters. The commune forbade evictions, resolved to annul back payments of rent on the grounds that, quote, work, industry, and commerce have become the full burden of the war. It is fair that property also make a sacrifice. All leases could be canceled if the tenants wished during the next 6 months. All rent holidays that had been given, if the tenants so wished, would be prolonged for another 3 months. Hotels were taken over to house refugees. There was a proposal that didn't ultimately pass to get the landlords to repay into the municipal coffers any rent collected since the outbreak of war. On the bills of exchange, the debt notes, it ordered the phase-in repayment of debts over 3 years, in contrast to the Versailles period of 3 months. And we could talk about why there was an agreement to repay the debts at all. I think it speaks to the Proudhon school and its influence. But Marx declared at the first international meeting in London, quote, the decrees about rent and commercial bills were 2 master strokes. Without them, 3/4 of tradespeople would have become bankrupt. On the pawn shops, there were targeted measures at returning tools, clothes, blankets, bed linens to extend payments over 5 years. The Labor Commission was run by a disciple of Marx and an immigrant, placed a ban on night baking. And on the issue of military production, there was an argument about whether they should revise the existing contracts to ensure that the workers making the military goods were paid a proper wage, and it wasn't a race to the bottom in terms of the contracts. On the one hand, people argued we need these contracts to be enforced now, we need the guns now. On the other hand, what the position that ultimately won was that the workers needed to be paid a fair wage, and essentially a minimum wage was in fact ordered. Other reforms carried out by the commune included the separation of church and state, the expropriation of church properties and free public education. The commune also effectively implemented a program of full citizenship rights for immigrants, with the prominent participation of a number of foreigners, who were some of the commune's most effective military and civil leaders. For example, Leo Frankel, the Marx disciple, was previously mentioned, was born in Hungary and had a history in the German workers' movement. Another of Marx's disciples, Elizabeth Dmitriev, was a Russian who founded the Women's Union for the Defense of Paris and the Aid to the Wounded, who was sent to Paris by Marx. And with Frankel's support, her union created a workers' cooperative, a women's workers' cooperative, which constituted 3,000 or 4,000 workers at any one time. And they fought tooth and nail to end sexual discrimination in the workplace, and were given contracts to provide clothes for the National Guard. Louise Michel was perhaps the most well-known of the women of the commune, organized a corps of ambulance nurses, tending the wounded even under fire, and saving the injured communards from the vicious nuns who ran hospitals in those times. The commune also reestablished the right to divorce, the right to civil marriage, the abolishment of religious vows, the right to alimony based on the right to separation, the right to governmental support regardless of so-called legitimacy of partner or child, the separation of church from state activities, including education. Perhaps the most symbolic act of the commune, which also often meets with the ire of bourgeois historians, was the raising of the Vendôme Column. In a party-like atmosphere, tickets were sold to the public spectacle of toppling this monument to the first Napoleon's military conquest. And on May 16th, the commune destroyed it as a symbol of their opposition to bourgeois militarism. The reaction subsequently built a big church that exists to this day on that location. And the artist Gustave Courbet was one of the best advocates for its dismantling, was forced after the commune to essentially serve in slavery to rebuild the reactionary church. The commune, both in the elected commissions and the broader meaning of the working class population which gave it allegiance, reflected a diversity of socialist thinking. Broadly, the three main trends being those who came out of the Proudhon school, the supporters of Auguste Blanqui, and the radical Republicans who saw themselves as continuing in the Jacobin tradition. Obviously, not every individual fit neatly into one of these categories, and not all of the measures which might be ascribed to the communards can be ascribed to one of those figures, always neatly fits in with those doctrines. Gluckstein, who published this book, The Paris Commune, A Revolution in Democracy, which I encourage people who are interested to read, points out that many of the communards belonged to the First International, where Proudhonism was dominant, but in which Marx also had adherents. Marx himself complained that the commune wastes too much time over trifles and personal squabbles. One can see that there are influences at work other than those of the working men, end quote. Nonetheless, the commune, having seized power, was driven by this logic to implement measures in the interests of the workers and the petty bourgeoisie, sometimes in contradiction to the formal program of its participants. The deputies of the commune council included the radical left Jacobin Charles Delacluze and around 40 other members of the First International. Again, most of whom were influenced by Proudhon, but some to a lesser extent by Mikhail Bakunin, whose main contribution in 1870 and 71 was to try to lead an uprising in Lyon, in which he declared the bourgeois state abolished, after which the bourgeois state showed up with 40,000 troops and crushed the uprising. There were also some supporters of Auguste Blanqui in the commune, who was jailed just prior to the declaration of the commune, and whose military strategic thinking would have been an asset, and who was very purposely kept in jail and was not traded by the Thiers government. However, on March 17th, the Blanquiists were conspiratorial. Their view was encapsulated by the Blanquiist leader in the commune named Raoul Rigaud, who said, "Without Blanqui, there is nothing doing. With Blanqui, everything." And they spent much of the revolution seeking to get Blanqui back. Rigaud is an interesting figure and one who was subsequently vilified and famous in the bourgeois press after the fall of the commune. He also represents some of the contradictions of the Blanquiists and the tensions between the competing school of thoughts. He was installed by the commune in the ex-prefecture of police and played an important role in seeking out spies or those complicit with the Versailles government. He was disliked by the Proudhonists, who believed that the police, quote, must be abolished and that an alternate force must be created in each arrondissement, in each community, and therefore opposed a centralized security force. Rigaud was also vilified for his prosecution of spies. Towards the end of the Commune, in May, a debate erupted about the need or not to return to the, quote, reign of terror, to enforce security in the Commune. In practice, any repressive actions were limited, and the accused were provided due process. At a time when the Versailles government was executing all communards who came into their hands, the criticism of Rigaud or those calling for a reversion to the terror should focus more on the Blanquiist method, which is anti-democratic essentially, than on the political need for security. The issue of the seizures of the bank assets provides a good example. Marxists insisted, not just Marx, that perhaps the single most important failing of the Commune was its failure to seize the banks. On March 20th, in need of cash, the Central Committee of the National Guard went to lenders to open a line of credit at their banks and were loaned 1 million francs. However, in the Bank of France itself, there were billions of francs, gold bullion, treasury bonds and titles of all kind, physical gold sitting in the coffers of the bank. Without the bank, all the capitalists would have been on their knees before the Commune. Thus failure to seize the assets was a lost opportunity. And it was the Proudhonists in the Commune who, bowing before the sanctity of private property, would not touch the Bank of France. For his part, on May 12th, Rigaud made an attempt with a small crew of Confederates to seize the assets of the banks, but did so without the authority of the Commune, and then was easily rebuffed. An example of having the right goal but failing due to the Blanquiist method, acting with a small group of conspirators without democratic authority. Ironically, some of the Commune's politics were in direct counterposition to the formal program of some of its participants. And these contradictions, by the time Engels writes his new introduction in 1891, these schools of thought had essentially ceased to have any valence in the socialist movement. It's worth thinking about that. Quote, this is Engels, by 1871, even in Paris, the center of handicrafts, large-scale industry had already so much ceased to be an exceptional case that by far the most important decrees of the Commune instituted an organization of large-scale industry and even of manufacture, which is not based only on the association of workers in each factory, but also aimed at combining all these associations in one great union, very much opposed to the Proudhonist conception. In short, an organization which, as Marx quite rightly says in the Civil War, must necessarily have led in the end to communism. That is the direct antithesis of the Proudhon doctrine. And therefore, the Commune also gave the grave of the Proudhon school of socialism. Today, this school has vanished from the French working class circles. Among the possibilists, no less than among the Marxists, Marx theory rules unchallenged. Only among the radical bourgeoisie are they still Proudhonists, who believe in free exchange and free labor, and ignore the importance of the state. The Blanquiists fared no better. Brought up in the school of conspiracy and held together by the strict discipline which went with it, they started out from the viewpoint that a relatively small number of resolute, well-organized men would be able, at a given favorable moment, not only to seize the helm of state, but also by energetic and relentless action to keep power until they succeeded in drawing the mass of people into the revolution and ranging them round the small band of leaders. This conception involved, above all, the strictest dictatorship and centralization of power in the hands of the new revolutionary government. And what did the Commune, with the majority of these same Blanquiists, actually do? In all its proclamations to the French in the provinces, it appealed to them to form a free federation of all French communes with Paris, a national organization, which for the first time was really to be created by the nation itself. So again, against the Blanquiist founding principles. Hal Draper noted that with the defeat of the Commune, the influx of communards to London, including many Blanquiists and their leaders, meant that for the first time they came in prolonged contact with Marx and his circle and the General Council of the International, which was based in London. There was considerable impact for them for several reasons. The role of Marx's writings in the Civil War in France, his writings to the First International as a champion of the Commune in the eyes of the scandalized official world, Marx's massive relief work for the refugees, the addition of a number of former Blanquiists to the General Council, were important in the subsequent evolution of the International and the fight against the Bakunin faction. The military interventions of the Commune were hampered both because it lacked serious military leadership and because there was an ongoing rivalry with the National Guard, which only gave up partial power to the commune. So there was a split in terms of this, who was in charge of security overall. There was never a clear centralized command of the armed forces. When the communards failed to march immediately to Versailles in March, Thiers and the forces of counter-revolution began to regroup. Starting in April 1871, the Versailles shelled Paris constantly, and through a deal with Bismarck, whose ideological hatred of the commune was intense, to say the least, they managed to have him set free 60,000 imprisoned French soldiers, increasing the loyal troops surrounding Paris. And after a series of very poorly led sorties against the Versailles between early April and early May, a turning point came on May 9th when the communards lost the fort of Issy, a key fort between Paris and Versailles. Finally, on May 22nd, the gates to the city of Paris at St. Cloud were left undefended, and a spy traitor signaled to the Versailles troops, who began to filter into the city. After the Versailles had entered the city, the communards fought desperately. But street by street, they were crushed. Men, women, and children were indiscriminately massacred. Some of the last fighting occurred in the workers' districts on the heights of Belleville. The wall of the communards and Père Lachaise Cemetery was where 200 communards who fought to the bitter end were put up against a wall and executed, and there's still a memorial there. Tens of thousands of communards were massacred by the Versailles in that last week in May, at least 30,000 people. Many of those who didn't die in the initial massacre suffered fates worse than death. Some were taken to Versailles, kept in open air, kept in the open or in dungeons where they died of hunger and thirst, cholera or gangrene. Some were sent on prison barges and kept tied up in tiny cells. Others were deported to New Caledonia in the Pacific Ocean, east of Australia, where if they survived the voyage, they were kept in cages below deck. And many died from malnutrition and to malaria and were overworked in prison camps. In the conclusion to his introduction, Engels writes of Marx's account of the commune, "The shattering of the former state power and its replacement by a new and really democratic state is described in detail in the third section of the Civil War. But it was necessary to dwell briefly here once more on some of its features, because in Germany particularly, the superstitious belief in the state has been carried over from philosophy into the general consciousness of the bourgeoisie, and even to many workers. According to the philosophical notion, the state is the realization of the idea, or the kingdom of God on earth, translated into philosophical terms, the sphere in which eternal truth and justice is or should be realized. And from this follows a superstitious reverence for the state and everything connected with it, which takes root the more readily as people from their childhood are accustomed to imagine that the affairs and interests common to the whole of society could not be looked after otherwise than as they have been looked after in the past, that is through the state and its well-paid officials. And people think they have taken quite an extraordinary bold step forward when they had rid themselves of a belief in hereditary monarchy and swear by the democratic republic. In reality, however, the state is nothing but a machine for the oppression of one class by another, and indeed in the democratic republic no less than in the monarchy, and at best an evil inherited by the proletariat after its victorious struggle for class supremacy, whose worst sides the proletariat, just like the commune, cannot avoid having to lop off at the earliest possible moment, until such a time as a new generation, reared in new and free social conditions, will be able to throw the entire lumber of the state on the scrap heap. Of late, the social democratic Philistines has once more been filled with wholesome terror of the words, dictatorship of the proletariat. Well and good, gentlemen. Do you want to know what this dictatorship looks like? Look at the Paris Commune. That was the dictatorship of the proletariat." End quote. The polemical power of Engels' point notwithstanding, from the perspective of 2018 and the experience of the 20th century behind us, including most importantly the first successful workers' revolution in Russia in 1917, we can debate whether we agree that the commune was the dictatorship of the proletariat. What I think is indisputable is the legacy that is found in the words of the Internationale written 1 month after the fall of the commune, and I will not sing them for you. And in Lenin's words from 1911 on the 40th anniversary, "The cause of the commune is the cause of the social revolution, the cause of the complete political and economic emancipation of the toilers. It is the cause of the proletariat of the whole world, and in this sense, it is immortal." Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.